This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Now your host, Roger Waldron.
Today, my guest on Off the Shelf is Rob Levinson. Rob is a senior defense analyst, is the senior defense analyst for Bloomberg Government here in Washington, D.C. And for today, obviously, we're going to be talking the DOD budget and what it looks like and the prospects moving forward in the future, what it means for contractors. But first, Rob, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Roger. It's great to be here.
I'm looking forward to our conversation about the DOD budget request and, you know, what it looks like, what it means for contractors, what it means for the federal market, but also what it means for our national defense, most importantly. But first, I wanted to give you an opportunity to let the listeners know a little bit about your background and, you know, and what you do for
Right. Well, my background, Roger, I'm one of actually two senior defense analysts at Bloomberg Government. Bloomberg Government is an online subscription-based service where we provide news, analysis, and data all about the impact of federal government action on business. And so I do defense. I have colleagues who cover finance, healthcare, some of these other areas. But it's always something that the federal government is doing, whether it's taxing, regulating, or passing laws or new policies, and what that means for business. That's what we focus on. So I do defense. My background, I'm a retired lieutenant colonel from the Air Force, served just over 20 years. I spent some time after that as a lobbyist, as a government contractor myself. And then I've been with Bloomberg Government since we really began in January of 2011. So a little over 3.5 years doing this job.
Well, yeah, and goodness knows the government's doing plenty of taxing, spending, and all those regulating all those things. So we do need people to parse the landscape and help us figure out what's going on. So let's turn to the budget, the DOD budget request. But first, I wanted to give you a chance to sort of give some historical context of where we are. You know, we've been through sequestration. I can't even say it; makes me so nervous. But you could give some of the background of how we are, where we are today.
Right. Well, I mean, you have to look back. We've gone through a cycle, really, for that we typically go through when we fight wars and we spend a lot of money on defense. And in fiscal 2012, defense spending really peaked. You know, depending on how you do the dollars, 10 to 12, we were really at a very high point, even higher than levels not seen since the Cold War in constant dollar terms. And now we're sort of on the downside of that, and we're coming down in historical terms. But we've also got this thing, it was called the Budget Control Act in July of 2011, I think it was passed, which actually set firm spending limits on both defense spending and non-defense spending. It basically lumped defense spending, which means that the Department of Defense mainly and a little bit of the Department of Energy and some other things that go for defense, and the non-defense spending. And this is all on the discretionary budget, not the mandatory stuff like health, Medicare, or Social Security, but all that discretionary spending, the stuff that Congress appropriates every year. And they basically set very hard limits on these things. And they said that if they even, they sort of gave them, put a gun to their own head, so to speak, with this funny word sequestration, which basically said, if we go ahead and we can't live with this and we appropriate more money and the president signs more money being appropriated, then the money will automatically be cut back down to those levels. And it'll just be a sort of across the board, non-thinking, peanut butter spread kind of an approach, which happened in fiscal 2013. Now, for 14 and 15, Senator Murray of Democrats in the House and Congressman Ryan from the Budget Committee in the House, excuse me, Senator Murray from the Senate,
right.
The two of them got together and had an agreement for basically 2 years that we're going to stick to the limits. They raised it a little bit, but basically agreed to stick to the limits for fiscal 14 and fiscal 15. Now, they'll go back in 16 to sort of seeing what they're going to do. The limits apply through fiscal 2021, so they got a few years yet where they can't go over those limits.
Okay, so let's start. Like, what is the limit for this fiscal year?
Well, they appropriated sort of right up to the limit for defense. I think it's $495.6 billion, and they're right at the limit. And Like I say, that's the limit for DOD. There's some Department of Energy spending that goes above that. But they appropriate, they're looking to appropriate right to those limits for 15 for both the defense and, again, the non-defense spending. Nobody's talking about going over those limits. So what it means is you're in a zero-sum game. You know, DOD has proposed a budget that's within those limits. And if Congress doesn't like something, that's fine. But they've got to cut something else to right. make up for something within that they might add within yeah. that number. Right.
Okay. And so each year that cap applies, and you couldn't theoretically say, okay, if it goes out to 2021 that you right. mentioned, you can't say, oh, we'll make it all up in the out years.
Well, they've done a little bit of that. No, the caps apply every year. Now they okay. have, what they've done is they said, you know, the total cut that they were looking for back when they passed the law was like $1.2 trillion. And they have played a little games where they've actually changed the cap in the out years. In other words, okay. spent a little mm-hmm. bit more this year, but they have to move that cap. They can't year to year, they've got to stay within the cap. So they can't, unless they all agree, okay, we'll raise the cap this year so we can spend a little more, but we're going to lower it next year. So we're sure. still sticking at our $1.2 trillion, or we'll even push it further out from 2021 to 2023, which they did that a little bit on some of the mandatory spending, because there was some cap on a little piece of the mandatory spending, Medicare, and they okay. did push it mm-hmm. out for a couple more years.
Okay, so the administration proposed a budget right up to the cap. Let's start talking about yeah. the details of that a little bit. Give some.
Yeah, it was kind of interesting what the administration did. So they proposed a budget right up to the cap, but then they came up with this other thing. They called it another funny acronym in Washington, OGSI. It's the Opportunity, Growth, and Security Initiative, where basically they said we'd want about $26.5 billion more in defense and more in about the same amount on the domestic side. They gave that to Congress. Congress so far has basically ignored that. They're not really paying much attention. But the administration was saying, we'd like to spend more money, and if you gave us more, here's what we would do. But we're going to keep it, you know, we do have a budget that's within that number. Now, that's what they did for fiscal 15. For 16 through 19, in defense, you normally do a five-year plan. It's called the Future Years Defense Program.
Okay.
And for 16 to 19, they're still proposing money above the caps. Now, that's just a proposed plan. And again, you have to appropriate every year. So next year, they're still going to have the fight. But they've said they want about $115 billion more than the caps would allow for those fiscal years from 16 to 19. And they say they need more to do some things to keep the Army the size that they want, to keep 11 aircraft carriers, to keep the Marine Corps at the size that they want. They need another $115 billion over and above the cap. So unless Congress agrees to raise those caps, you know, there's still going to be continued fight. In other words, DOD's plan in the out years is not in compliance with those caps. And so DOD will have to make some more painful cuts if it can't get all the money that it wants.
Okay. So, and really that is telling Congress, hey, unless you do this, we're going to be doing some even further cuts. And
right. I mean, in one sense, DOD has come to this
like
reluctantly.
It's a game of poker here or something, right?
Yeah.
Or,
well,
or,
you know,
or chicken, all right.
In 14, it was like DOD, and 13 and 14, they sort of pretended the cuts weren't even going to happen. They proposed their budget. This time, they're still saying we'd like the cuts not to happen, but at least they're showing Congress, okay, if you don't give us the money, here are the choices. We're going to lose an aircraft carrier. We're going to lose about 30,000 people in the Army. We're going to lose some people in the Marine Corps. And so Congress really has those sort of hard choices in front of them about what these cuts really mean. And some people, even people who supported the Budget Control Act originally, people like Buck McKeon, who's the chair of the House Armed Services Committee, you know, he voted for this thing, but he never thought sequestration would happen. And they're having a lot of buyer's remorse because they're realizing the real pain that they're feeling here.
Sure. So are there other, I know this Opportunity, Growth, and Security Initiative, sort of sounds like nice to have things that they'd like to be able to do. Are there other highlights before we get into further detail about the budget that you focus on? I understand that services each are taking sort of different approaches.
Right.
To it.
You know, again, this about this budget when we were commenting in Bloomberg government, it's not quite there yet in terms of when I say there yet is conforming with the absolute fiscal reality, you know, but they're getting there. They're getting closer. And each of the services in this budget, you really see they're making hard choices. And each service, the military services, took a little bit different approach. The Air Force.
Well, you know what, Ron, we do have to take a break. That's a perfect place to stop. When you come back, we'll start with the Air Force and then go through the other services as well and talk about their approaches to the budget. But right now we do have to take a break. My guest today is Rob Levinson. He's a senior defense analyst with Bloomberg Government, and you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Rob Levinson. Rob is a senior defense analyst for Bloomberg Government here in Washington, D.C., and we are talking the proposed DOD budget. And when we took our break, Rob, you were just about to talk about the varying approaches to budget and capability and, you know, the future of the services, and you had mentioned the Air Force, so why don't we start there?
Right. So like I said, each of the services, they're living within, you know, starting to live within this budgetary reality and having to make the choices. So the Air Force is really clear about the choices that they're making. It's about, they're looking at the future and they're saying, look, we're going to cut force structure, we're going to cut people, and we're going to use that money to buy the new stuff that we need. We're going to buy the F-35 fighter jet, the most expensive, you know, program in Pentagon history. We're going to buy a new bomber aircraft. We're going to buy our new tanker that we want. They're very much making that bet on the future and those high technology systems. And this is sort of in keeping with the Air Force. It's very typical. In fact, the other day, the Air Force announced, you know, Secretary Hagel, as part of all this, announced he wanted a 20 to 25% cut on headquarters staffing across the services. And he said, we can do this in 5 years and save a few billion dollars. The Air Force says, we're going to do it in 1 year. We're going to cut those people in 1 year. And this is, you know, some of those people are obviously active duty military, they're government civilians, and they are contractors providing professional services. So the Air Force is going to do that in 1 year. So again, they're going to get rid of the people as fast as they can to save the money that they need for the. On the other end of the spectrum is probably the Army. And when I say the other end of the spectrum is the Army is spending money for right now. The Army, 82% of their budget is just going to those personnel costs and operation and maintenance, the sort of the day-to-day stuff. The Army doesn't have any big weapon systems on the horizon for any of their, you know, replacing any of their major combat systems like the Apache helicopter or the M1 Abrams. In fact, they don't want to even buy more tanks. The Congress wants to make them buy tanks. It has to do with keeping plants open and things like that.
Industrial base
issues, yep. Absolutely. So the Army is kind of, I almost say the Army's in a wait-and-see mode. The Army is trying to figure out where its future is. You know, the part of the strategy is we're not going to fight big land wars anymore. You know, what we've done in Iraq and Afghanistan for a decade of keeping lots and lots of troops on the ground, we just don't want to do that anymore. And that's what the Army does. And so it's the Army is in sort of even an intellectual quandary about what do we do? And until they sort of figure that out and the country figures out what it wants from the Army, it's hard for them to make big investment decisions. So it's probably smart in a way of, you know, let's not make a big bet on some big procurement program if we don't know what we want to do. Let's figure that out first, and then we'll make the bets on whatever systems we want to buy. So the Navy's kind of in the Navy, and I lump the Marine Corps in there because the Marine Corps Navy is sort
Marines,
of a team.
I'm sure they don't like that.
They don't like that, but their budget comes from the same place. So the Marine Corps, in a way, the Marine Corps has, in fact, in terms of what its role is, has in some ways the easiest job in the sense, not that their job that they do is easy, but the Marine Corps wants to get back to being the Marine Corps. And the way I put it is, and I don't mean this in a pejorative way, but the Marine Corps has been playing second string to the Army. It's been another land force in Iraq and Afghanistan, basically doing the kind of mission that the Army's really meant for. The Marine Corps wants to get back to being the expeditionary force, doing those kinds of things that it does well. So the Marine Corps knows where it wants to go. The Navy has this quandary of, you know, the Navy, more than the other two services, has a huge peacetime mission. That is, people depend on the Navy to be around the world. It is the global presence of the United States military. Yes, we have bases everywhere, but they always say when a president gets in a crisis, the first thing he says is, where are the carriers? He wants to know where his aircraft carriers are because that's the forward presence of projecting American power. So the Navy has to do that during peacetime, but it also wants to invest for wartime. So it's kind of splitting. It's got to spend money on that current operations budget, but it's also got to invest for the future. So it's got to buy F-35s. It's looking at a new armed drone, the U-class program, and there's some quandary about that. But the Navy's kind of in that middle of trying to balance the force of today with the force of tomorrow. So if I would, you know, sum up, the Air Force is looking at the force of tomorrow, the Army at the force of today, and the Navy's kind of balancing in between the two. That sort of easily sums up where the different services are going.
Okay, so I'm going to ask a few questions in
sure.
these areas. First, with the Air Force now, you know, R&D money for a new bomber. It seems like to me it's such an expensive, you know, I think about the B-1 bomber, you know,
right,
B-2
no.
bomber, and how much those cost in the dollars at that time that they were developed versus, you know, 10 years out, however long out before you even begin to think about the procurement program, the development manufacturing. It seems like just very expensive proposition.
Yes, the Air Force is really in a quandary with this one. My colleague Kevin Brancato and I did actually a study where we looked at every bomber the Air Force has procured since World War II, basically, and all the bombers. And they all get more expensive and have lower numbers. Now, the Air Force says they want to buy 80 to 100 of these new bombers, and they only want to spend $550 million a copy. That's less than they spent on the B-2, and they only bought, you know, at the end, they only 20? Bought 21, yeah, 20. Then one crash, so they have 20 operational right. B-2s. But $550 million in today's dollars is a lot less than they paid for that B-2. And I've asked the Air Force, I asked Pentagon Comptroller, and he says, this is going to be the real challenge. Can the Air Force hold down the requirements? Meaning, we can't have every nice-to-have feature on this aircraft and keep it within those cost structures. There's no way. I think the Air Force is going to be very hard-pressed to keep it to $550 million a copy. They're either going to have to cut back on those numbers, or they're going to have to. It's going to have to get more expensive. Somehow, they're going to have to play, I think, $550. So you're right. The bomber is particularly an expensive proposition for the Air Force, and to get the price that they want, the numbers that they want, they're going to have to break a historical trend, which I think is going to be very difficult to do.
Well, that leads me to, you know, some next question is, you know, if it's a traditional bomber, right, let's say you have pilots and people you have to train, you know, to fly the thing, that's an additional cost. No, and so I'm going. Where I'm going is, you know, what's the vision for, you know, drones in the Air
Force?
Well,
with the bomber, the Air Force, the talk so far is they're looking at what they call an optionally manned option. So it may be a kind of aircraft that they could pilot remotely or have pilots. It's not sure. You know, there's a tough thing because this is going to be, among other things, it's going to have the nuclear mission. And I think people get a real uncomfortable with the idea of arming a nuclear armed aircraft and not having
a computer,
pilot.
Just a computer, right?
Right. They want a pilot who, if they have to push a button and drop one of those things, they want a pilot there to do that.
Right. One of the things also I wanted to ask you about is cuts. Where, you know, with this, you know, investment in, you know, the F-35, the bomber, the tanker. There's some big expensive programs. Are there areas where they've cut things?
Yeah. In fact, I think, and this is where I think the Air Force made very realistic decisions. In fact, you know, that $115 billion extra I talked about, none of that's for the Air Force. The
Really?
Air Force, okay. The Air Force budget, and they've said this, our budget is consistent with that five-year defense program. So the Air Force made some hard calls. They cut the A-10 aircraft, which is a close air support aircraft. It's meeting a lot of resistance in Congress. They're also cutting the U-2 reconnaissance aircraft. The Air Force, the chief of staff made a very interesting decision, which made a lot of sense, is he said, look, I can cut a few aircraft from across the fleet, you know, five aircraft here and five there, but I save a lot more money if I actually take a whole class of aircraft. So if I've got to cut, say, 200 aircraft,
sure,
if I eliminate a whole class, then I get rid of all of the logistical tail, all of the training, all of that infrastructure. So they said, rather than sort of peanut butter spread cutting aircraft, let's cut out some classes of aircraft. We're going to cut the A-10. We think we can do that mission with the F-35. We're going to cut the U-2. And we think most of that mission can be done by the Global Hawk, which is an unmanned aircraft. Mm. That's also a historic decision, as you're replacing a manned aircraft with an unmanned aircraft completely. You know, these unmanned aircraft up till now have been additions in capability. This is replacing one for one. Again, it's meeting some resistance in Congress, so it's not a done deal by any stretch. But the Air Force made some pretty, I think, what could only be described as pretty courageous decisions when it did these kind of things. Not decisions it necessarily likes, but given the budgetary realities, it sort of made some tough calls.
Right, and you mentioned earlier, too, the staffing reductions that they've committed to do in a year, I guess.
Right. They want to get 20-25% of their staffs down in a year. That's tough to do, to get those down in a year.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is, and you touched on another thing I was going to ask you about, congressional, you know, opposition to some of their cuts is, I did recall hearing, in particular, like the A-10 fleet.
Right. The A-10, that's meaning
that's jobs,
a lot of resistance.
Location.
It's not as much jobs in the sense that the aircraft's already made. We're not buying any new A-10s. But where the location is, like in Arizona, that's John McCain's home state. That's where a lot of the A-10s are based. Plus, there's a lot of people say, you know, this mission, this aircraft, which is very important really to the Army, because it goes and it flies low. It's a low, slow, tank-killing aircraft designed for close air support. The Army guys love it. And they're afraid that the Air Force won't do the same mission with the F-35. It's too fast. There's some fear there. So there's pushback there. The U-2, there's pushback as well. The other area where Congress is pushing back is, and this is across the services, is personnel cuts in terms of not so much in the people, but in the benefits.
Right. And, you know, we can talk about that, Dernek, when we talk about the Army as we start our next segment. But right now we do have to take a break. My guest today is Rob Levinson. He's a senior defense analyst for Bloomberg Government. And you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Rob Levinson. Rob is a senior defense analyst at Bloomberg Government. And Rob, when we took the break, we were about to get into discussion of personnel, a little bit more about the Army's strategy and approach. But I did have one question I wanted to ask you, because we touched briefly on the F-35 and the most expensive procurement program in the history of the United States Defense Department. What does it mean? Because, recent reports like out of Canada that they've sort of finally, I guess, after revisiting it, have decided to purchase the F-35, from a budget perspective and just what it means for the program overall, what kind of impact does that kind of thing have if the Allies start?
Well, it is a fairly serious thing. You know, the F-35 was designed from the beginning to not just be for the U.S. military, but for these allies. There's 9 partner nations which all contribute. Canada is one of them, which actually, as being part of the partner, you basically agreed to buy the jet, but you also get some of the contracts and the work to help build the jet. And Canada, you know, had approved the sale. They were all ready to buy it. And then there was some balking at the long-term cost of the aircraft. Not just the purchase cost, but the maintenance cost, the training cost. And the Canadians, it became a political issue in Canada. And they said, okay, wait, we need to take another hard look at this. So the latest reports I've seen is they took that hard look. They're still going to buy the aircraft. And it does mean there's about $9 billion estimated contracts from Canadian companies to build parts of this jet. And that probably produced some internal pressure in Canada to help them make this decision. Plus, Canada's so tight with the United States, they didn't want to anger us. But it matters because, you know, lots of other countries are buying this aircraft, and the more aircraft you make, the lower cost per aircraft goes down. So if Canada had backed out, if other countries back out, that means less numbers get produced and the cost begins to go up. So it is important. It's also important sort of symbolically for Lockheed to show the acceptance of the jet. Interoperability for NATO is important. We want all the NATO countries to use this. Lots of important issues. So it is important that these foreigners stay committed. But the expenses are making a lot of them, sort of think twice about some of this.
Right. So that's good news, Canada, right? So let's turn to, the Army and, personnel issues. And you mentioned in the previous segment that, the Army's sort of making this investment in its people, and it's sort of trying, as sort of as a, I don't know, a staying action while they, as things sort out what the vision for the Army's role in the future, whether from a national dialogue and a strategic perspective. So what does that mean from a cost perspective? I know one of the things we wanted to talk about is the costs of maintaining personnel and the benefits and all that sort of thing, and what it means long-term for the department and for the nation.
Right. Well, for the Army knows it has to shrink in size. It's going to go from about 520,000 down to about 440,000, 450,000. Although if it doesn't get that extra 115 billion, its piece of that extra 115 billion that I talked about, it could go down to 420,000. So it's real tough for the Army. It's tough days for the Army. Like I say, the country said it doesn't want to fight these big land wars. So all of its big weapon systems, whether you're talking about, they canceled, the old Future Combat System. They've got, they don't have successors to things like the Apache or the M1 tank or those things. They're kind of in this wait and see mode, deciding what is their role, what does the country want from them before they make big investments. So they're spending a lot, and they're spending a lot on operations and maintenance and personnel. And this personnel issue brings up this larger issue. The department knows, I've talked about, DOD's caught in sort of this squeeze. The top line is coming down because we've ended the war. We've got the Budget Control Act, the caps we discussed previously. But we've got this internal cost growth of personnel. It's not so much more people, but more people are getting more expensive, both civilian personnel and the military personnel, things like TRICARE and the pensions and the other benefits. And DOD keeps proposing, and they've done this for years now, proposing to Congress some modification of those things. Full disclosure, look, I'm a military retiree. I get TRICARE, I get a military pension, and these are great benefits, but they're very expensive. And DOD's tried to look at how it might be able to trim some of these. May people, retirees like me, contribute a little more to TRICARE. maybe trim back on the growth of pensions or some of those things. Congress is extremely resistant to all of these things. They basically shoot every one of them down when they get over to the Hill. And that becomes very difficult because, again, when you've capped that top line, it's rob Peter, pay Paul. And so right. If DOD is not allowed to make some of the changes to personnel and save money there, it's got to come out of those other things. It's got to come out of weapon systems. It's got to come out of training. And those are difficult things. You know, one way it's been put, which I think is appropriate, is, you know, we sort of make two promises to our troops. We make a promise that we'll take good care of them. And if they get hurt, that if they retire, we're going to give them a good package. And that's important. That promise is definitely important. But we make another promise to our troops. And that is if they go into a fight, they are trained and equipped to win that fight and come home to their loved ones. And if we start breaking that promise because we're trying to keep too much of the first promise, we're doing something wrong and we need to make some hard decisions. And Congress is probably going to have to step up to this, but it's tough. It's politically very volatile. Oh, you're cutting things for the troops. You see the scandal with the VA, which is a separate budget, but it's the same idea of, oh, you know, nobody wants to cut benefits to our troops. They've sacrificed enormously over these past couple of past decade, really. And they do a tough job that the country wants them to do, and we want to take good care of them. But we're coming to that push comes to shove on, we also want them trained and equipped to fight. And you know, we're risking that capability to pay some of these benefits.
Is that sort of, I mean, you know, you made the great point about the Army focusing on personnel costs and, you know, eliminating equipment because it's not quite sure what its role is. You know, is that sort of symbolic of this issue? I mean, in a sense that you're spending, you know, they could make some decisions, but they don't have the financial capability to do that, or does that not
well? That's part of it. You know, in a perfect world, like the Army has had to cancel some programs because they say, you know, we don't want to invest a whole lot of money. You know, when budgets are fat, as they were for about a decade, as we mentioned, decisions get a lot easier. You know, Admiral Mullen, just before he retired, last chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, you know, he said, we at the Pentagon have lost the ability to make decisions because he was so concerned. The budgets were so fat, people weren't having to make hard choices. Well, now we're in that era of hard choices. And those are painful choices. It's tough for Congress. And I understand why Congress pushes back on certain things. These are tough choices. Nobody likes this environment that we're in. None of these decisions that the Air Force made or any of the other services make, they would say, in a perfect world, I'd make the same decision, but I have to make a decision in the world I do live in.
Right. And I guess, you know, one of my questions for you, I was thinking, is with regard to Apache helicopter or M1 Abrams tank, they don't, I mean, they're still capable platforms,
right? These are still terrific platforms, and they do have money for upgrades to those platforms. There's a lot of money for what we call in the budget world, it's called mods, modifications. So they're not buying a new Apache, but the Apache today looks a lot different than the, you know, first Apaches that came off the production line. They've added a lot of systems, they're upgrading it, same with the tanks. Same with the ground combat, you know, the armored personnel carriers or Bradleys and things like this. They add capability to these things. So it's not like the Army's capabilities aren't improving in these systems. It's just not, they're not just making that sort of, they're making evolutionary progress rather than revolutionary progress.
Sure.
They don't have a new system on the drawing board that says this will be, you know, a huge increase in capability. They don't have that on the drawing board right now, but they are making steady modifications and improvements to the systems they do have.
Right. Well, you know what? Rob, we're already up on the break. Okay. So we're going to take our last break. But when we come back, we'll talk a little bit about the Navy, its focus on, you know, where it's going with its budget, a little bit deeper dive, and talk about the, you know, the pivot to Asia as part of that. And then we'll also talk a little bit about contingency operations and the end of those and what that means for, you know, the budget and for contractors and logistics, I think. My guest today is Rob Levinson. He is Senior Defense Analyst at Bloomberg Government, and you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Rob Levinson. Rob is Senior Defense Analyst for Bloomberg Government. And Rob, when we took the break, I mentioned that we'd come back and talk a little bit more about the Navy and what's going on in the Marine Corps. You didn't talk about the Marine Corps seems a bit more focused on what its mission is and what it wants to get back to its roots as an expeditionary force. The Navy,
Navy's got this balance. Like I say, they want, and a lot of that has to do with the number of carriers right now. They've said if they don't get that $115 billion extra, they can't really get that 11th aircraft carrier.
And that $115 billion is outside the caps, right?
Right, that's above the caps. Right. If they don't get that money in 16 through 19, they can't keep that. They basically got to refuel the George Washington, and the refueling is refueling the nuclear, and they sort of stand it down. If they didn't get the money, they would just take the George Washington basically offline. And so we'd have 10 aircraft carriers instead of 11. They made some hard choice on the littoral combat ship. There was a lot of controversy about that. You know, it's a smaller vessel. They were going to buy 52. That's over the long period of time. They've cut that back to 32. They're cutting a bunch of aircraft. So they're making some tough choices, trying to maintain
On the littoral combat, is that built by two different companies?
Yes, there's two different. There's a Lockheed version, okay. And then there's Austal, which is an Australian company, and they have a couple versions of this aircraft. And the Navy was buying both, actually, okay. And they were sort of competing them and trying to get some cost savings by fostering that kind of competition. But there's been a lot of controversy about the LCS, and so they backed off on some of the buy. Secretary Hagel made some comments. He had lost a lot of confidence in some of the capabilities, I think, of that vessel. So their Navy's taking another look at what it wants.
I interrupt you. We're talking about the carriers.
Yeah. So the Navy, you know, if they don't get the money, they can't refuel the carrier. They're going to go to 10 aircraft. Now, again, this is another one that Congress doesn't like. The House put money actually in the 15 budget to refuel that carrier. The Navy said even if they're going to refuel that carrier, they don't need the money till 2016. But the House put the money in 15. I think the Senate doesn't look, at least the authorizers are not putting it in the 15 budget. They'll put it probably in 16. But that's a tough call for the Navy. The Navy also, the other big thing that's going on in the Navy is this armed drone program, the U-class program. And there's some controversy there. The Navy put out a requirements document. There's like four contractors competing for this thing. Some people think the Navy needs to be very aggressive and get a really stealthy attack kind of a drone that maybe even could replace manned aircraft, replace some of those F-35s that the Navy's planning about. Some people felt that the Navy requirement that it put out wasn't ambitious enough, and there's some legislation that will force Secretary Hagel, if it passes, to actually relook at those requirements and maybe make them look for a more capable aircraft rather than a less capable one. So that's still a fight, but that U-class, there's a lot of potential there because the range on that aircraft, the capabilities, could significantly extend. You know, part of when you think about aircraft carriers, it has to do with the radius of the jet from the aircraft carriers, how much sort of space you can control. And if you can get these U-class that can go out, 1,500 miles or something, maybe you don't need as many carriers because you have jets that can go a lot further, longer endurance. There's some math that may work in your favor. So the Navy's still sort of struggling with where it wants to go with that U-class, but there's definitely a community inside the Navy that thinks that U-class has a lot to offer. You know, they've had a prototype X-47 made by Northrop Grumman. It's already landed off a carrier. I think this summer they're going to actually fly it off a carrier with other manned jets sort of in the pattern. So you'll have F-18s in the pattern with, this X-47 mm-hmm. in the pattern. So that'll be interesting.
Right, and they, if I understand correctly, they've already reduced the number of F-35s.
Right, the total number, I think they reduced, I think the number is 33 of the total Navy buy. Now, the Marine Corps hasn't reduced its buy. You know, it has the vertical takeoff version of that jet, which is very expensive. Marine Corps remains committed to that capability. The Navy has already backed off a little bit on their total buy of the F-35.
Yeah, and real quickly, the pivot to Asia that,
there's a lot of talk about
how does that impact the Navy
right.
and its mission?
It probably impacts the Navy more than anybody else because, the Pacific Theater is the Pacific Ocean. It's mostly a Navy theater. So the Navy's looking for ways to sort of move a little bit more presence, maybe keep ships on station there a little bit more. In declining budget eras, it's not like there's a whole lot of forces that could be shifted there or new money going to Asia. But the Navy is exploring ways to keep more of a presence. Of course, that's being challenged now. Got things going on in Europe. The president announced he wants $1 billion more for defense presence in Europe. So that may take away a little bit from that. But they're trying to look more at particularly what China's doing in the South China Sea and things like that, and putting a little bit more Navy, sort of on station in the Pacific for probably longer periods of time during the year.
Right. And the latest thing on China I heard was that they may build, create an island in South China Sea and one of these coral reefs or something to build a runway or something. So interesting. So another area I wanted to touch on quickly is the end of contingency operations and funding for that or how it's I assume they're still bringing stuff home
right
or disposing of it there that costs money.
Funding for the wars has been what they call OCO, Overseas Contingency Operations. And basically this year, the Pentagon didn't put forward an OCO request. They said, because we got to wait till we get an agreement with Afghanistan about how many troops we're going to have there. Because really, there's almost a one-for-one equation. Is a certain number of troops equals a certain number of dollars. They put in $80 billion, basically, which is the same figure that they had for 14. They put that as a placeholder, and they said that. And Congress did the same thing. They said, we'll put $80 billion as a placeholder. Now, we still need an agreement from the president of Afghanistan. As you know, President Karzai, the current president, didn't want to sign an agreement.
Yes.
Both of the presidential candidates are supposed to have a runoff later this month. They both said they will sign an agreement. Assuming that sign, the presence that we're talking about is about 9,800 troops on the ground. If you work that out, I worked it out. At the peak, in terms of contracting, we were spending about $16 billion on contracting for work in Afghanistan for the military, for DOD. If you work out to that 9,800 troop presence, if you, again, do that sort of one-for-one equation of ratios, you get to about $2 billion a year in contracting in Afghanistan. So big decline in that work.
Sure, wow.
And if you look at the OCO request, what it would likely be based on that 9,800 number, it's probably between 20 and 25 billion. Now, I heard some reporting that said it's going to be much higher than that. And that may reflect some of the withdrawal costs and some other things. So it could be higher than that, at least for 15. But that 9,800 number, the president says, you know, that's only going to last a couple of years and they're going to cut that. So that number and companies that made a lot of money contracting Afghanistan, those numbers are coming way down and they're coming down pretty fast.
Wow. Okay. That's great. And we have about 2 minutes left. And I wanted to give you a chance to talk about the R&D sort of priorities that DOD is laying out when you look at the budget.
Well, yeah, again, and this somewhat goes in line with those you know, previous strategies we talked about each service. The Air Force is increasing its RDT&E, its R&D money. Not a huge amount, but it is increasing it. The Army is actually decreasing. Again, the Army, again, focused on that force of today rather than the force of tomorrow. The Navy actually is increasing a significant percentage, about 8.5%. But that's driven by some big systems that the Navy got. We talked about that U-class, that armed drone, possibly. They've got a replacement for the Ohio-class submarine. Hugely expensive program. Lots of money there. They've got R&D money set aside for that. There's also some money for a new presidential helicopter. Recall, they had a program. It got canceled. They're doing that again. There's some R&D money there. And so again, the services, you know, the Navy looking forward, the Air Force a little bit looking forward, and then the Army not really looking as much forward because it's focused on that force of today, and that's reflected in some of those R&D budgets. And then DARPA is sort of, you know, looking at very sort of out of the box kind of stuff. That's what DARPA does. Looking at advanced computing. I saw an interview with the head of DARPA, and she was talking about her biggest opportunities now in processing massive amounts of information.
Sure, yeah.
That DARPA really wants to invest in that capability. Because they think that there's... The other thing DARPA is really starting to look at, which is kind of interesting, is R&D to get the platform cost down. You know, everybody said that these, like the F-35, these things are just getting so expensive. And trying to come up with ways of developing capabilities that don't cost so much, you know, is really important. It's not just having the best technology, but having technology we can afford. And DARPA is really looking. Space launch is an area that DARPA is looking at. It's very expensive to put stuff into space. They're trying to, so they're not doing just research on scientific advancement, but scientific advancement sort of with efficiency or with cost savings.
Sure. One last question. Cyber, what, you know, the investments there.
Yeah. Cyber is one of those areas that's going to continue to be hot. You know, that money is going up. The NSA, a lot of that money, of course, is classified and we can't see a lot of that money. But cyber is going to be a hot area. Everybody wants to invest more in cyber. You know, we're so dependent on our networks. There's money in DOD, Homeland Security, and some other budgets because we've got civilian infrastructure that's important. And most of that's in civilian hands. It's not in government hands. But cybersecurity, everybody's very concerned about this threat. I saw a report today that said they have evidence now that 3 utility systems have been shut down by cyber attacks, not necessarily in the United States, but worldwide. Right. They didn't name where they were. It was an extract of a report that some of it was classified. But so people are very worried about this, and there's going to be continued investment in, on both the defensive and offensive side.
Rob, thanks so much. It was lots of great information. I really appreciate it, and I know our listeners do. I want to thank my guest, Rob Levinson. He is a senior defense analyst with Bloomberg Government, and you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.